The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
And this is from the Transmission of Light, Vasumitra. Vasumitra placed a wine vessel in front of Michaka, bowed, and stood there. Michaka asked him, "Is this my vessel or yours?" As Vasumitra thought it over, Michaka said, If you consider it my vessel, yet it is your inherent nature. Then again, if it is your vessel, you should receive my teaching." Hearing this, Vasumitra understood the uncreated fundamental nature. Kazan's verse, "If the frosty dawn's bell rings as it struck, you never need an empty bowl here." This vessel, is it mine or yours? This collection was done by Kazan, who's a few generations after Dogen, and it's kind of unusual within the koan literature because it's said to be the enlightenment experiences of all of the ancestors, beginning with the Buddha and ending with Ajo. One of Dogen's principal heirs. And in the early, particularly the Indian teachers, because there was such a paucity of information in the old tradition in India, keeping history was not evidently something that was really done or valued. And so a lot of this material that is drawn, the biographical material, is, Dharush used to say, this is a very esoteric collection of koans. There's a lot of magic and supernatural stuff going on. And even the historical validity of each of these teachers in a direct line from the Buddha to Ajo and then on down to us here is in question. But in the establishment of the lineage in Zen, as Chan was developing in China, that was very important for a number of different reasons. And so the lineage was formed. And whether each of these teachers is historically both accurate in terms of them being that person and or whether they were actually in that line of lineage is not really for us so important. What we do know is that the Dharma has been transmitted all the way since the time of the Buddha through peoples in each generation and through that very important relationship between the student and the teacher. This vessel, is it mine or yours? Does it belong to the teacher or to the student? Teachings sometimes talk about being a vessel of the Dharma. Oftentimes that means is the teacher recognizes that a student may have the capacity to not only realize himself, but to become a Dharma holder or a lineage holder, a teacher. In a larger sense, being a vessel of the Dharma is each of you. Having found your way to the Dharma, having sought that out, having done some good things in your life, such that that was possible, and practicing means that vessel is alive and well. In the Uttara Tantra Sastra, which is a teaching on Buddha nature, says the perfect Buddhakaya, kaya is vessel, vehicle, the perfect Buddhakaya is all-embracing. Suchness cannot be differentiated, and all beings have the disposition. Thus, they always have Buddha nature. The Buddha has said that all beings have Buddha nature. Why? Since Buddha wisdom is always present within the assembly of beings, since this undefiled nature is free from duality, and since the disposition to Buddhahood has been named after its fruit. It's all-embracing. It reaches everywhere. Nothing is forsaken because that nature which we all possess has no boundary, inside or outside. It can't be inclusive or exclusive. It can't accept or reject. It cannot be differentiated because it is one nature, like the great ocean, like the boundless sky. And sentient beings have the disposition. How do we know that? Here you are. And yet, as I said the other day, a few things need to be taken care of. So Vasumitra was the successor of Nichaka. This is very early. This is the eighth ancestor from the Buddha. And when he meets him, he says, oh, it's said that Vasumitra, when he was young, had a wine vessel that he carried everywhere. And so when he met Nichaka, he had the wine vessel. And he said, do you know what I have in my hand? Does Vasumitra know what he has in his hand? When we enter the path, do we know what the vessel is that we are bringing into this journey? Is it my body? Is it my mind? Is it my feelings? Is it my memories and beliefs, my personality? Can inhabit all that we take as ourselves so carelessly. And yet when we die, we sure don't want to lose it. It's the seat of our dis-ease, and yet we cherish it. We want to be free within it, yet we can put up a good fight to let go. Kazan said, even if you understand that mind is the way and body is Buddha, this is still a defiled vessel. And being a defiled vessel, it is inappropriate for the pure. Pure here means, it doesn't mean being, you know, a saint or sanctimonious. It means free, awake, clear. He says, you may understand that it encompasses all of time, and you may know that it is forever complete, which is all true. But this is still a defiled vessel. What past or present are you talking about? What beginning or end are you talking about? Views like this are inappropriate for the pure. In other words, as we become more clear, we understand that beginning and end, past and present and future, right and wrong, are what the Buddha called convenient designations, ways to refer to things that we experience in the world and that we can speak about, right? And so we are given a name so that when we want to call out to someone, we don't have to say, you third from the right. But that we mistake the name, we mistake the nouns, the words, for creating or being a definite thing, self-existing. And so he says this view is not appropriate for the pure, for one who has seen through that. And then we can use those words, use those terms. We can tell stories. We can tell our own stories and not be fooled, not be deceived by them into thinking, that's who I am, that's who I was, this is the absolute truth. You know, more and more as as I was getting ready for this earlier, of when I talk about student-teacher and sort of, you know, raising bodhicitta, the beginnings of that stirring that happens within each seeker of the way, each seeker of the Dharma. And I remember I was in my room, which I shared with my brother, my beloved older brother, about a year older, and we were doing homework. And I don't know what precipitated, but we just started talking. And he started talking. And he was just sharing things he had been thinking about and sort of ways he had been seeing things. And I remember just feeling like scales were just falling. And that I just felt like he was opening up a world that was really just beginning to think about things rather than just, you know, being a teenager and that. It's like being a teenager, being in my life, thinking about things like it's happening, it's now, I'm involved in it, what is it? And so it was like that beginning, you know, I mean, there had been stirrings and mostly just feelings of like, you know, discontent. But that was the first moment where I felt like really he was sort of quite unwittingly and innocently introducing me to thinking, examining. I remember years later, I was in L.A. visiting him on my way back from New Zealand, where he used to live. He used to live in Los Angeles. And we were out walking, and I was telling him this story. And it was like, you know, like, oh my God, man, you like did this for me. And it's like, I love you. And he was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And it didn't matter, you know. And it's like, how often has somebody done something for us? And they have no idea. We might not even know in that moment the impact of what happened. But later, I think of teachers who were so important to me and who I would be fighting with and resisting, and you know, but they cared. And they were in there, like, holding my feet to the fire about something related to my schoolwork. And I was resisting, but they got to me, right? They didn't know that. So that's why it's always important to just practice. Give. What is our aspiration? Why is that so important in Buddhist practice? Why is there so much emphasis on raising bodhicitta? Is it just to remind us that our practice shouldn't be just for ourselves, but should also be for others? But bodhicitta is not just, you know, an intention to realize ourselves, an intention to help others. Where does that come from? What is causing that to be aroused? That's aspiration. That's the seat of bodhicitta. That's why when somebody wants to enter into formal training, right? Dada Roshi years ago realized it's important to, in a sense, slow things down and create what he called barrier gates. Right? To stop and to be asked questions, to reflect, to try and get clear. You don't have to do this. Right? Why do you want to do this? What are you seeking? What is motivating you? What do you think this is? So that when we enter, our eyes are at least half open. In the Prajnaparamita Sutra, because Machaka talks about being pure and not being pure, Shariputra asked the Buddha, undefiled, O Lord, is purity. Being undefiled is purity. There's an interesting way that the sutra sometimes works where there's kind of a calling and responding, a singing and singing back that goes back and forth. And so Shariputra sings out, undefiled, O Lord, is purity. And the Buddha responds, because of the absolute absence of all defilement. And Shariputra says, through the non-defilement of what is there purity? And the Buddha says, the purity results from the fact that form, sensations, perceptions, mental formations, consciousness, are in their essence, original nature, free from defilement. Thus, there's purity. Free from defilement, free from anything that constricts, confines, limits. That's our nature. So Dada Roshi, in this setting up of the eight gates, established what he called Zen study, or as a way of talking about studying with a teacher. That the part of the what a lineage means is that every teacher has a teacher. And that doesn't end when the teacher dies. I still have a teacher, right? That when we form a relationship with somebody, particularly one that's significant, that doesn't end. if and when the person's life ends, it just changes its shape, changes its form. And so what is the teacher meeting the student meeting the teacher? Dogen, in his fascicle on face-to-face transmission, says, Shakyamuni Buddha saw Mahakashyapa in person. Mahakashyapa saw the Venerable Ananda in person, and Ananda bowed formally to Mahakashyapa's Buddha face. This is face-to-face transmission. Ananda maintained this face-to-face transmission, closely guided Shanavasa, his disciple, and transmitted face-to-face. When Shanavasa respectfully saw Venerable Ananda, he received face-to-face transmission, just face-to-face. So when we talk about face-to-face teaching, right, we are sitting face-to-face. But Dogen is looking at this in a very deep way, in an important way. It's not just that we happen to be in the same room, facing each other. There's something happening. Shakyamuni Buddha saw Mahakashyapa in person. He could have never known what that means now, right? Post-COVID, Zoom. Of course, he means it in a very particular way. He doesn't just mean that we're actually sitting in the same room. Thank you for that. But he's saying he saw Mahakashyapa in person. Buddha saw Mahakashyapa. Buddha saw Mahapajapati in person. Kweshan saw Liotiemo in person. The teacher sees the student in person. The student trains so that they might see the teacher in person, that they might see themselves in person. The Buddha saw Ubiri in person, Patachara in person. You know, that story that Ojin Sensei told yesterday that's so compelling, so overwhelming, to think of such a cascade of tragedy. What more could there be? How could you not lose your mind? And when the Buddha met her, clearly he was not afraid. He was not overwhelmed with her grief. He was not intimidated by her grief. He clearly was not deceived into thinking that his job was to fix her. He said, Patachara, come to your senses. It's time. It's time. He knew the reality of grief. He knew its cause. He knew its potential for cessation. And he knew the path. He just presented that to her in a way that got through. In the 8 Gates, in this chapter on Zen study, Dadaroshi talks about how we create a sense of self, and that self becomes our barrier. And it says the ego shell is the barrier, and we must become it and realize the self. In other words, we can't keep separating ourselves from the barrier, which is what we do when we grab onto it, what we do when we reject certain aspects of ourselves. We just make it stronger. To realize the barrier is the self is to realize the self. The barrier then becomes you. You become the barrier, and there's nothing else. Or realize we just realize that there's nothing really there. This is the self teaching the self. This is the self realizing the self. And then he says, isn't this what Dogen is talking about in the Mountains and Rivers Sutra? Where Dogen says, since ancient times, wise ones and sages have lived by the water. Sometimes this teacher is referred to as being somebody who fishes and fishes for a student, throws out a hook and tries to catch a student. When they live by the water, they catch fish, or they catch humans, or they catch the way. These are all traditional water styles. And going further, they must be catching the self, catching the hook, being caught by the hook, being caught by the way. In ancient times, when Chuanzu suddenly left Weishan and went to live on the river, he caught the sage of the flower in river, who was living by the river. Isn't this catching fish? Isn't it catching humans, catching water? Is it not catching oneself? And then he goes on to say, my teacher meeting Me is my teacher meeting himself. It is me meeting myself. Isn't this the Buddha meeting the Buddha? Isn't this my teaching you, my meeting myself, you meeting yourself, and the Buddha seeing himself? We say that to realize oneself is to be intimate with oneself. To be intimate with oneself is Buddha realizing Buddha. This action verifies and actualizes the enlightenment of all the Buddhas in the 10 directions. That's what is meant by face-to-face transmission. And that it's experiential, right? It's not information, it's not knowledge. Told the story that Daido told Roshi when he was at the temple years ago, probably before the temple, I don't remember, but he was doing a retreat, everybody was sitting in a circle, and somebody was asking about transmission and said, well, you know, but it's like when you tell somebody something, that message, and then that message is told to the next person, it breaks down, you know, like the telephone game. You tell somebody something, that by the time it comes back, it's almost unrecognizable. And he said, no, it's not like that. And they said, what's it like? And he slapped the person next to him. And he said, pass that around. So everybody slapped each person. When it came back to him, he said, yeah, it's intact. If it were only that easy. But what is the toll, what is being sacrificed when we do not meet? When we do not meet the teacher, we do not meet ourselves. Can we prevent the teacher from seeing ourselves? I remember years ago I had a new student. This was very early in my teaching. And he had just done Tonkara. And I don't know if it was actually during Shokan when he was asking for the teachings or the first interview after that. I don't remember. But it was a normal interview, you know, talked a little bit about practice. And then afterwards, he sent a letter, and he said, I quit. He said, there's no way that this can ever work, that you can ever actually be my teacher, unless we spend, basically the implication, we have to spend lots and lots of times hanging out together, talking to each other. You have to know my story. I have to tell my story. That's obviously not going to happen in a few minutes. I'm out. Okay. He was right that none of that stuff was going to happen, or not in the way he thought. But what is lost when we do not meet? Is there a difference between meeting our teacher, meeting ourselves, and meeting a spring day, meeting a task, meeting a prostration, meeting a Buddha? That's what we call dukkha. Not meeting. We call it samsara. We call it pain and confusion. We call it time swiftly passes by and opportunities are lost. You know, one of the things I love about living in the Northeast, I mean, we had seasons in the South, but they were, you know, more subtle, is that they're more vivid, right? Each season is its own living creation. And so, each season, you know, I sort of mark the firsts, like with spring, the first night when I'm walking back to the Abbasi and I hear the spring peepers, that first night. The first day, last Sunday, the windows are open in the Zendo. Ah. The first tick, I've already had mine. The first flowers, the first crocus, the first daffodil. Isn't it wholly appropriate? It would make me believe in God that the daffodil, one of the first flowers, is such an incredibly happy flower. I mean, is there a happier flower than a daffodil? You never see it like sad. The first spring rain, the birds returning, all of those firsts. And yet, do we meet them? Do they get under our skin? Do we see what's happening? Dogen said, thus the authentic ancestors of all generations have continued face-to-face transmission. Disciple seeing teacher, teacher seeing disciple. An ancestor, a teacher, or a disciple cannot be a Buddha or an ancestor without having face-to-face transmission. It's like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly, or like transmitting the lamp and allowing it to shine forever. In thousands of millions of transmissions, the trunk and branches are one, breaking an eggshell by pecking from the inside and outside at once. It's referring to the image of a hen pecking at the egg, peck, 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 and the egg inside, tuck, 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 peck, 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 tuck, 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 and finally it cracks open and a new life has come. And so this, he says, is face-to-face transmission, and that this is how we are here now. And we can think of this in terms of formal transmission, but what he's talking about is that, but it's also every moment in which the Dharma is being conveyed, being received, being experienced. Sometimes we know that that's happening. Oftentimes we don't. Not in the moment. We don't know. That becomes clear later. Disciple seeing the teacher, teacher seeing disciple. We don't use that term so much, a disciple. It's a nice term. It means a follower, a student, a believer, an adherent. So not all of those really fully apply. A follower of the way. I don't think of it so much as following a teacher. It's not so much based in belief. I was thinking, is it kind of like being an apprentice? You know, in the age-old tradition, you know, of apprentice studying with a master craftsman, somebody who has great skill, seamstress. And the definition of an apprentice is a person who's learning a trade from a skilled employer, having agreed to work for a fixed period at low wages. Well, they got that right. And I was thinking of when I was a music student, oftentimes when I was working on a piece, I would play it, and my teacher would say, wait. And then he would play it. He said, now you play it. Then I would play it. He said, no, listen, listen. And then he would play it again. Calling and answering, calling and answering. So there's following an example, there's a modeling. But when I played, it was me playing. He wasn't saying, imitate me. He was saying, listen to the music. He was the vehicle by which the music was coming. I said, listen to the music and let the music come out. Let it come from you. Let it come from me and let it be true to the music. I was thinking also when I was studying composition. So traditionally, one of the ways you learn to write in the style of Bach, style of Mozart. So you study their writings and you write in the style of, but you're not trying to imitate them. How could you? But you're writing in the style of, it's very similar. It has to come from one's heart. It's not imitating, but it's also trying to stay true to the style. And I thought, isn't that very similar to what we're doing? We're trying to stay true to the Dharma because that's the path that we can rely on, that we take refuge in. But it has to come from within, right? When we study with a teacher, we're following examples. I definitely followed the example of my teacher. And I learned from all of his positive qualities, and I also learned from some of his difficult qualities, right? And every teacher teaches in terms of, you know, the ways in which the Dharma manifests well and also through their imperfections. I remember saying to a new student recently, I will disappoint you. And they looked at me like, I said, no, really. Not because I intend to, but because that is going to happen. We all have expectations. We all have certain ideals, idealizations. It's actually an important part of it. And so to follow a teacher is to follow the path, to follow the Buddha Dharma, so that we can begin to meet. Isn't that what's happening in Zazen? Face to face. Your face, meeting your face. And so in practicing, we enter into the mind stream of the Buddha, of these ancestors. In every koan, we're entering into the mind stream of these teachers. In studying with a teacher, we're entering into their mind stream, and the teacher is entering into the mind stream of the student. In the very early years, when Dada Roshi was establishing and teaching and setting things up, and as he said, just doing it like it's going to happen, like it is happening, we were entering into his, not only his mind stream, but his his vision, what he was trying to do, what he wanted to do, what he was trying to create. We didn't know. He called it a monastery. Okay. Right? He talked about these various forms of training. Okay. Right? So, you know, I learned how to do these different things, but I didn't really know. I didn't have his mind. I didn't and experience his training. And at every step along the way, and I think an important part of why he's there at the eight gates, was he wanted there to be examination and discernment. Don't just do this stuff. We don't just bow because we do just bow when the bell rings. Just bow. And we don't just bow when the bell rings, right? In other words, what are we doing? Not analyzing it to death, thinking it to death, parsing it out and dissecting it and pinning it to a board, but bringing it to life. What is it in here? So in a sense, I am the apprentice. I am following the examples of my teachers. They did prostrations. Okay, I do a prostration. I don't really know what that is. My body seems to be able to follow that fairly well. That's part of it. But am I meeting the prostration? Right? When we're involved in any practice that feels somewhat empty, that's the gap. Whether it's actively through resistance, whether it's because we want to try and figure it out and we can't, or whether it's just because we haven't yet met it. And I imagine many, if not most of you, have had an experience where you had an experience of some simple aspect of practice that got in, that entered in, and you experienced something. You feel, I'm not talking about enlightenment. I'm just talking about something was touched, something true. A string was plucked, and it was in tune. That's the transmission happening. Is this my vessel or your vessel? As Vasumitra was thinking, that it is neither I nor, it's not mine or it's not yours. Michaka said, if you think it's my vessel, but you have Buddha nature. So it wasn't Michaka's vessel. But then again, if it's your vessel, why are you here? He said, then you should receive my teaching. Therefore, it wasn't Vasumitra's vessel either. It's not my vessel. It's not your vessel. So it's the vessel itself is not a vessel. This is why the vessel disappears. This is what is happening in training, that the student and teacher facing each other, sitting apart, one guiding the other, begins to merge. The mind is known, right? It's like, how can the teacher know a student's experience? They're not experiencing their experience. They need to have had certain experiences to be clear about that, and then to be able to see when that is being expressed through the body, through the words, through the eyes, through actions, through what is said, through what is not said, until the vessel is no longer a vessel. And this is why patience is so important. You know, and maybe we should really, I think we should actually, really factor in when we think about why is this difficult, why does it take so long, blah, 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 you know. We've all had that, perhaps are having that particular conversation. Maybe we should throw into that pot the fact that we live in a culture which in some ways is so anti-training, right? It's anti-patience. No patience for patience. It's transactional. You better be getting something for your money, right? And that we absorb that, right? We grow up in that if we grew up in this country. And the aggrandizement, the enshrining of the self, the enshrining of the ego. right? And so that's got to be playing a role. I was thinking about how we've talked recently on a couple of occasions about how in the early days, when the Dokusan line was called, running, right? Helter skelter, leaping over people. And there was, you know, there were some problems. Right? People who weren't so fast always ended up at the end of the line. Sometimes people got bumped a little. Some people's enthusiasm became aggression, you know, or just like me first, you know, crowding somebody out. And so we started to temper that a little bit. And I think that was appropriate. And something was lost. You know, I got to tell you, when I sit here and I hear the Daisan line called, and I see some people getting up, and it's like, you think you're going to live forever? Are you going to a chat? Are you going to have a cup of coffee? Is your head on fire? You don't have to knock somebody down, but part of what that was doing was instilling, bringing, it was either just expressing what was already there, or was helping to bring forth a sense of urgency. Right? I remember doing, I think it was Shoan talked recently, or maybe it was in Yermando, about when the Buddha came upon the ascetics and they referred to him as friend, and he said, he had to reorient him. Our relationship has changed, he was saying. All right. And then I remember doing Dokusan, I think it was during an introductory retreat, and some young, or maybe a new resident, came in and sat down and goes, what's up? I was like, where to begin? Oh, the blessed bell. Speaks volumes. Raises questions. It's not a chat. It's not a discussion. I never went to Dokusan. Even the very last time when I thought, this is probably the last time I'm going to see my teacher in this room, after all of these years, I never went in casual. I was always sitting at the edge of my seat. Always ready. Always with some degree of question. How can I use this? How can I meet this? To be a student. You know, that question of the question. And I want to think about that a little bit in terms of how we introduce or talk about Dokusan or Daisan interview. In terms of, because sometimes when I'm talking to people, they seem to have the sense that they need a question or the question. You know, it's like there's the right question and you better get to it, right? Sometimes people will come in and say, you know, I don't really have anything important to say. And then they'll ask something which is actually very important. Sometimes setting it up that way can create a sense of, you know, an idea of something. It comes from within. As Dharma practitioners, we're studying the way, which means self, other, karma, impermanence, death, conflict, fear, joy, impatience, everything, phenomena. And that to want to know, to want to understand, to want to meet, to want to live this life, and not just have passed through it. To not want to miss this opportunity that I have been given, that you have been given. That is the fire on top of the head. When you have a fire in your head, you're not going to put it off till tomorrow, right? That's not even a question. You're not going to think, you know, I was really on my way to something. This is most inconvenient. It assumes its place. And that's a really essential part of practice, is making contact with what is important. And there are many things in our lives that are important. Our families, the people we love, the work that we do, our blessed earth, our time, power, and misuse of power. There are many things that are important. Is there anything that unifies all of them? Is there anything that runs through all of them? Is there an undercurrent? Is there something that permeates them? Not in terms of an ultimate solution, but in terms of you, me, living in this world with all of these important matters. Is it just a matter of going from one thing to the next and completing tasks? Is there something I want to know? Is there something you want to know? Is there something, a way you want to be in this life? A sense of it. I was just reading earlier in this Prajnaparamita Sutra, there's a passage where Shariputra asked the Buddha, if someone encounters the Dharma in this lifetime and really is drawn to it, has an affinity and begins to practice, does that mean that in a previous lifetime, in the teaching of rebirth, in a previous lifetime, that something happened, something particular happened? And the Buddha said, oh yes. It means that in a previous lifetime, they encountered the Dharma, and they didn't just encounter it, but they examined it. He makes this very clear point. And they examined it, he says, with Maitreya, with the Buddha of the future, with the teacher. And then they counter-examined. They didn't just ask a question and got their answer and said, okay, thanks. They counter-examined. In other words, they continued to examine. They continued to want to know. They continued to question. Right? What? That's what lies in the heart of that student. That is what we can speak of as the great matter. Right? Dada Roshi spoke of the spiritual imperative. But those are words. Is there any person who doesn't on some level know that they're going to die? Knowing that they're going to die, how can that not bring up the question on some level of what is this? What is this then? Right? Something about recognizing mortality brings that finite lifespan into question, as it should. And then what? And then what? What do we do with that? It's in a way an inconvenient truth, right? It's uncomfortable. It doesn't have a ready-made answer, right? Nobody's standing outside the door ready to resolve this for you. We actually have to leave home like the Buddha did. We have to leave. We have to be discontented. And not only abide by that, but actually increase it. The teachings say you cannot actually do this without adversity, which is might seem like a bold statement from the Buddhist perspective. It's just truth. It's just fact. It's not an opinion. The nature of human beings is that we need to understand what we're in the midst of in order to begin to wonder, to want to know, to see. And that urge is inherent within human beings. Maybe it exists in other creatures. Maybe they work it out in their own way. Maybe it's worked out from the beginning and it just doesn't arise, but it sure as hell isn't like that for us. And that's a good thing. Because then we can seek, we can encounter, we can practice. Dogen said it is like pouring water into the ocean and spreading it endlessly, or like transmitting the lamp and allowing it to shine forever. In thousands of millions of transmissions, the trunk and branches are one. They're one. We can think about different moments in our lives that might have been important, influential, like I described with my brother, that might have been shifting moments. Something changed. Suddenly we were actually turned towards the Dharma, like in the Lotus Sutra. The child who leaves home and is a vagabond and is becoming more and more destitute, right? All the while left a home of riches. And the Lotus Sutra simply says one day they turned back in the direction of their home. And that is one of my most favorite lines in all of the sutras. It's so unassuming. It doesn't explain, there are no fireworks. But in that, one day, they just turned in the direction of home. That is full. Like pouring water into the ocean. This is why the Buddha in the Prajnaparamita Sutra said, I have so much gratitude to wisdom. Think of that. We think of realizing it, practicing in accord with it, having faith in it. But the Buddha in the Sutra says, I am so grateful for wisdom because it is by virtue of wisdom that everything that has happened here, is happening here, has come forth. So, how do we express our gratitude? I think you know.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.